So, like I said, my name is Nicholas, and I write software. And I'm going to tell you about, describe the Dropulous, which is a programmable peer-to-peer data store that I've been working on in my spare time, because that's the sort of rock and roll lifestyle I have. And the problem that I have is a growing uneasiness with the current state of the web. And this can be illustrated in three ways. Number one, that users are no longer in control of their data or their online identity. For example, users have to use websites that act as walled gardens of data. Each website, of course, has its own set of credentials that you have to use to log in. Once you've logged into a website, there's no guarantee you're ever going to be able to get your data from out of the walled garden. Furthermore, there's a question of provenance and trust in the users that you find on the internet. For example, is the user X on Twitter the same user X as on Facebook? There's no way of telling, so we're joining back up. The second problem I have with the current state of the web is that developers have to use quirky and complicated technology in order to make the web work. Often this technology is specified in a top-down fashion by a committee. You only have to look at web developers' grimace whenever you mention such wonderful things as OAuth 2, cross-origin resource sharing, JavaScript data objects is a good one, or dare I say, Internet Explorer, just to know what sort of a mess internet-based, web-based technology is. The third and perhaps the most worrying thing about the current state of the World Wide Web is that inadvertently built into the way that the web works are many points of control, authority and lock-in that can be used to disempower and exploit users on the web. I'm sure we can all think of lots of different ways in which this happens. So there's the blocking of the Pirate Bay here in the UK. What else? There's the kerfuffle over payments and WikiLeaks as well. And there's the addition, of DRM in HTML that's coming along. So from my point of view, the beautifully simple hypertext system, the beautifully simple, open and decentralised hypertext system that Tim Berners-Lee thought of all those years ago has become a closed, complicated and centralised system that seems to be beholden to commercial, legal and political manipulation. Now, as I'm sure you can probably tell, this is not something that sits very well with me. And I was thinking about this, and I came to the conclusion that much of what I don't like about the current state of the web is that it's contrary to a concept that I think is very important, and that concept is autonomy. And by autonomy, I mean someone is self-directing and free from interference from a third party. Autonomy also implies some sort of intelligence so that you're able to appreciate the freedom that you might have and make decisions about what you want to do with that freedom. Being able to make decisions is also a way of taking responsibility. Could you just move your watch, please? Because it's just shining right in my eye. That's the thing. Sorry about that. So where was I? So it's important to be able to make decisions because it means that you are then take responsibility for your actions, which is important from an ethical point of view, obviously. Also, autonomy is the opposite of such undesirable states as tyranny, slavery, and other nasty things. ignorance and apathy, that's what I meant to say. So I sort of sat down, as you do, and I wondered, well, how would a networked technology that was designed specifically to promote autonomy function, how would that work? So I sat down, started hacking, and this Dropulous thing was born. So it's an experiment, obviously. And as I said, it's a programmable peer-to-peer data store. So how does it work? Well, that's what I'm going to tell you. It's an experiment, and it's also sort of a political statement as well, and that it puts forward a certain point of view as to how technology should work within society. And it's also a place where I can play around with ideas that have been knocking around in my head for quite a while now. So how does it promote autonomy? Well, the Dropulous is federated, decentralized and open data store that's programmable by anybody. It uses cryptography in order to sign digital assets so that we can ensure users' identity, ensure that users' data is not tampered with. So let me unpack that a little bit. So it's federated in that there are many different entities that cooperate with each other in order to make the globulus work. It's decentralized, which means that there's no single entity more important than any of the others. And this has the advantage, obviously, that there is no central point of authority that could be used to limit access to data stored in the globulus or make use of the resources that the globulus provides. So unlike the web, which is a client-server model, obviously the globulus is a peer-to-peer system. It's an open system. So by having a node on the Droplets network, you are free to extract data or put data into the Droplets without prejudice. It's also a programmable environment. By that I mean it's like a distributed development environment. So another way of thinking about it is that it's a little bit like SETI at home, a really highly reconfigurable SETI at home on steroids. So by having a node on the Droplets network, you are allowing your local machine to provide just a small part of its computational power to the rest of the network so others can use that for computation. I also mentioned that we use cryptography. We use public key cryptography to ensure users' identity in the network and to sign digital assets so that we can tell the provenance of the data as well. The interesting thing about public key cryptography is that there's no central point of authority that tells you who's who. Rather, it's a far more humane web of trust model to know that you're talking to the right sort of a person. As those of you who went to the key signing party, I believe there was one at lunchtime, will be able to tell. So that's kind of what the Droplets does. How does it work? Right, okay, so this is the interesting bit for me anyway, because I'm a programmer. So there are three elements to the Droplets. The first is a distributed hash table that acts as the data store, and is the mechanism by which users find each other on the network. The second is the aforementioned public key cryptography for ensuring users' identity and the security of their data. And the third is a very simple Lisp-like programming language that I've written that I call Logos. I'll go through each of those three things in turn now. So you all know what a hash table is. No. Okay, so a hash table. So think of the distributed hash table as a global peer-to-peer dictionary. Okay, so some unique key is used to identify some arbitrary digital value. Okay, so in a traditional dictionary, for example, the key is a word and the value is the associated definition of the word. Okay, so you look up what the value is. But because this is a data store, obviously you have the code-like operations. Users are able to create, retrieve, update, and delete data that's stored in a distributed hash table. Okay, but the hash table. So a hash table is a key value store, basically. The hash table is distributed because, just like a traditional dictionary, it's split up into conceptually something similar to volumes. Okay. So in a traditional dictionary, you have different volumes that treat different parts of the whole dictionary. Okay, that's the same with the distributed hash table. And everybody who joins the network has a copy of just one volume. But that volume may be distributed to many different people on the network. And users who use the distributed hash table keep track of other people on the network and who holds what volume. Okay, so if you want to have an interaction with somebody via the distributed hash table, you ask your friends, give me, I know you've got volume, whatever I need, could you affect the change that I need in the data store? Okay. If I don't know anybody with the appropriate volume, I know people from A through to Y, but I don't know anybody with the Z volume, for example, there's a sort of an interesting game of 6 degrees of separation played with friends of friends and so on and so forth on the network until we find somebody with the correct volume, and then obviously the interaction takes place. Obviously, that's a really, 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 very, very incredibly simple way of describing it. It's a lot more technical than that. The other interesting aspect about the distributed hash table is that it works similarly, has a similar property to BitTorrent, in that if there's a popular item in in the distributed hash table, it becomes more widespread within the data store, which means it's easier to find, which means the performance of the data store improves. Okay? So the distributed hash table algorithm that we use is called Kademlia. You can go and look it up. There's a very interesting paper from about 10 years ago that describes how it works, Kademlia. And the innovation that that Oculus brings is obviously the public key cryptography that's used to ensure that users don't trample all over each other's data. Okay? So key value items are actually self-contained and signed, so you can tell who this data belongs to and where it comes from. And any item that doesn't pass the cryptographic checks is ignored by nodes on the network, and any nodes that try to propagate such dodgy items are punished by being ignored and blocked by other nodes on the network. Okay. And what was the third thing? Logos, the programming language. So you program the drug list with Logos. Like I said, it's a Lisp-like programming language, so it's homo-iconic. Do you know what that means? Some of you do, some of you don't. Okay, homo-iconic means that basically the code is data, is code is data. There's no differentiation between code and data. This has an interesting mind-bending effect in that Logos programs can manipulate other Logos programs in order to enhance the Logos programming language itself. So it means that developers don't have to wait for don't have to wait for a language designer to come up with some new feature. They can use something called a macro in order to manipulate the Logos programming language to better suit their needs. Since Logos programs are also data, they're stored in a distributed hash table as well. And they run as what I call ensembles on remote nodes in the network, and a result is given back when the ensemble comes to some sort of a consensus. That's sort of a magnetic use. So if you think Paxos-like algorithm, it makes you not exactly Paxos. Logos programs are sandboxed to protect nodes that they're running on, and they are deliberately curtailed in terms of time, how long they're allowed to run for, and space, how much memory and other resources on the local machine they're allowed to use. Okay? So I kind of hope that you could see that at every point in the design and the implementation of the Oculus, I've tried to make the outcome reflect the political and ethical considerations I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, is to promote autonomy and openness at the expense of authority and close centralization and things like that. So here's the thing. So I work in London, but I live out of London, and I have 40 minutes on the train every morning to do this. So the Oculus isn't finished. So the distributed hash table is almost finished. The cryptographic layer is done. Logos is what I would describe as in the advanced stages of planning, with some experimental code written, which means it's not done yet. So one of the reasons why I wanted to come here was to describe the drug list, although it's in its incomplete state and there's not really anything useful you can do with it at the moment, just to see what sort of a reaction I might get from people if I talk about the drug list. And by the looks of you, you're thinking, who is this idiot? So, I'm going to end now. So, I've got 1 minute left. There we go. That's perfect timing. What was I going to say? So, I'd better just stop, really. If there are any questions, please... Okay. I was going to say, contact me by email. I'll obviously answer questions now. The code's on GitHub. It's open source. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I'm actually going to try to answer this question as part of my talk, completely randomly. How many people here have started a project of any kind? And how many of you have found it to be like a one-man project that, you know, eventually you get burnt out? Okay, it's kind of the default pattern. So my name is Peter Hinchins, and what I do is I build online communities. So I try to turn 51-week projects into, you know, one year project by helping people to work together. And I will try to explain my best experience and practice in this area. And I've done this now for a long time. I began writing open source in 91. Most of my projects fail, and some succeed very well. So I start like Nick with ideas and vision. I want to build these amazing things, and I end up spending a year on the train hacking on software, which eventually dies. Community is the answer. Community means people that can replace you as the founder of a project and that can do things that you cannot do. Researching papers, understanding technical problems, simply applying the intellectual effort that one brain cannot apply. So it kind of changes your vision as a person who wants to make projects from an engineering point of view to a social architecture point of view, which is what I call it, social architecture. Building communities, helping people work together. So I try to boil this down into about five elements. It's a lot more than that. So first of all, it's growing the community. It's very well to say I have my project on GitHub, but how do you grow this? How do you get people to join this project? That's the first thing. And how do you grow beyond a certain size? This is a very large project. You know this is not going to succeed with a team of 2 or 5 or 10 people. It needs 1,000 people working on it. So how do you get to 1,000 people? And 1,000 people, they will argue and they will fight. They will fight if you're 10, they'll fight if you're 2. So the next thing is, how do you survive conflict? And how do you turn conflict into something more positive, competition? And many of the communities that I've worked in died because of arguments between the founders. And it can be incredibly toxic. I worked for years on the software patent debate, if you remember that. And we had this very large European NGO, FFII, German-based, and I was president for 2 years. And the thing imploded by people simply fighting over power in this NGO. So how do you turn that kind of energy into something more constructive than, you know, toxic emails? And then, when you have all these people interested in working together, how do you define where you go? How do you keep 1,000 people or 10,000 people or even 2 people heading in a direction which makes any kind of sense? And finally, how do you keep this going for a long time? I've been working on projects which are now 10 years old. And how do you, during 10 years, keep some kind of continuity and accuracy? The long-term aspect is very important. Anything useful will take a long time to make. You can think of an idea in your bathtub or around, you know, at the bar. But actually making it work and making a real difference in the world will take 10, 20 years. Without any question. So, I will kind of go through a number of tricks. And interrupt me at any point if you find what I'm saying doesn't make sense or if you want more explanation. So, the first thing is the mission. Now, it's good to have a nice name, a nice logo. What's much more important for me is to have a very clear mission. What are you trying to do? What makes this exciting? What makes this project worth getting interested in? Why should I go to your GitHub page, you know, GitHub site, fork your project, and actually look at it? Why should I bother? And if your mission isn't clear, if it isn't exciting, isn't slightly crazy, you won't get those people who will kick it off. So your first mission is aimed at the pioneers, people who are really looking for new stuff, who are very excited by impossible projects and will go and take effort to the new thing. Over time, mission gets softer and softer, because as over time, your community will talk to the leading edge and then the mass market, and the mission gets gentler. At the beginning, it's going to be slightly crazy. After you have your mission, you have some kind of usable product. Working a year on something which nobody can use is going to kill you. You want to work for a week, 2 weeks, and make something that does something useful for somebody. It's very important, because those guys who come to your GitHub project, they're not going to just invest out of passive, you know, out of just fun of coding. They're going to want something they can try, they can run, they can use, gives them some value, and they will contribute to. It's going to be very straightforward. I was playing with this MIDI keyboard downstairs, you saw that. And I bought that, £40. And I want to get that code, I want to hack it, and I want to see my code running and making sounds in about 4 hours. If I don't get that working, I'll get bored, I'll throw it away. And that's how it is. Smart people get bored really quickly. So if you want those smart people to join your project, you're going to make it interesting really, really fast. Then you've got to make it really simple for people to join. And that means taking away barriers. Taking away anything that makes it harder to understand hard to get into. Any concepts that are in there which you don't need, you remove. Any functionality which isn't really, really immediately important, you get rid of. Make it simple, 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 simple. And the simpler, the easier. And the easier, the more people will join. And as you go through your growth process, as your community grows, what you're looking for is new blood, looking for new people to join. The founders, the people who've been there from the beginning, become more and more of a problem as you go through, and that includes yourself as founder. The founders have particular ideas, they have particular visions which become insane over time. They become the problem, and if you're a smart founder, what you do is you get out of the way, and those people who don't get out of the way, you assassinate, you get rid of them, you get them out of the project, and make room for new blood on a permanent basis. And you can measure your success rate by how many new faces join every week. You don't care about the ones being there for a year. And all their knowledge, all their experience is worth nothing because they will use it in a bad way in the end. And they will get emotionally attached to the project, they will try to own it, and they will subconsciously reject new ideas and reject new directions, and that will kill the project. So then we come to the roadmap and how your project actually continues to be successful over years. Because the funny thing is, when you make software, when you make any kind of structure, is that your real requirements only emerge over time. In fact, you don't know what you need until you start using what you've made. This is a big reason to not make stuff. That's why making a year's project is a waste of time, because you're making the wrong thing for a year. And you only find that after a year, which is really, really sad. So what you want to do is discover the reality of your problem over time with a very lightweight approach. And the lighter the better. It means making less. And having lots of eyes and minds looking at the landscape of what you're trying to do. And so in our projects, the roadmaps are emergent. That means there's no formal vision, there's no formal roadmap. There's just people with use, with problems. And as they use the software, they discover problems, and they come with solutions. And we have this saying in our communities where you either bring a patch or you bring money. That's it. Bringing an issue, we don't care. Bringing an idea, I give you a finger. You're bringing a feature request, I just laugh at you. It's that simple. If a problem is a real problem, then you will either bring patch or you bring money. And if you can't afford patch or money, the problem is fake. And there are an infinite number of fake problems that we ignore very happily. And that's how you keep your architecture lightweight, by not making stuff you don't absolutely need to get to the next step. And there's other, you throw away old stuff as soon as you can as well. Eliminate what we call technical debt, which is hard. Now, how to resolve conflict? How many of you have been in communities that had no conflict, that were completely peaceful, where no one ever fought about anything? Okay, there's no hands here. I think human nature is like that. We like to fight over stuff. We like to attach our egos and emotions to issues and make them important. It's how we feel important. And a lot of this is psychology. It's how do you turn human nature from destructive to constructive. When I have three kids. So if I give my kids food to eat and say, here kids, eat, eat, eat. They'll look at me and say, nah, I'm not going to eat. And I know they're hungry. I know they like it. But they're going to just argue with me because I'm like that and they're my kids. So I don't do that. I put the food in the middle on one plate. And I say, it's forbidden. And they all start eating. And they're competing with each other. And they pull this food off and they eat it. And they know that if they don't eat it, their brother will eat it, sister will eat it. So they go in for this food as fast as they can. Problem solved. They're all fat and happy. So by creating competition, you can remove conflict. And creating open competition and real competition. And we know this works in the real world. We know that when businesses compete, they do much better. We know that monopolies are very bad. They make everything rotten. So in communities, you create competition by having architectures where teams can fight. This morning, I saw this presentation on the EMF, the electromagnetic field. And imagine that you had to make the Wi-Fi, an abstract problem. And you have these two guys arguing over how to do it. You just say, look, we'll do two systems. The best one wins. Go for it. And they both make their systems. And it sounds redundant, but in software, that's cheap. In software, you can make stuff and throw it away. So when you get people arguing over how to do things, just create parallel projects and ensure they can compete for the same market. If you have different insecure systems, but let them compete for the same applications. And then finally, longevity. How do you make things last for a long time? And that's really the hardest one, because anyone can find the energy or the spare time to work on stuff for a while. But how do you keep it going for decades? And the only answer I have is economics. You have to have a model where the economics work. There has to be benefit to everybody involved. It doesn't have to be money. It can be karma. It can be reputation. It can be just the passion of teaching people. But there has to be an economic reward for every single participant, or they will go away very quickly. And that's part of either the good luck or the design, is figuring out how to make people win when they come into this project. How they win by learning stuff that is valuable to them, by getting technology before others can get it, by improving their own products in some way, or their own knowledge, or something. Or by making money from selling stuff to their customers, whatever it is. If there's no economics behind it, it will eventually just dry up and die. And that's it. This seems to work. This is not really yet a science, but it's getting close. I have a couple of books on this subject. One is called Software and Silicon, which you can find online. It'll be in print in summer. It goes into horrible detail on why this works and how it works. And we have time for three questions. 1 minute each. I have a question here from Nick.
Okay, so you're talking about either give us a patch or give us some money. What about people who can't program, who don't have any money, yet they have a legitimate problem?
Well, then we have to find someone, to convince someone else to actually do the work for them. Because if you, I've done this, I've made software that was insanely useful, and where people come with requests, like, I want to do this, I want to do that. I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. I love programming. This is a good exercise. And as an exercise, it's fine. If you're learning to program, that's fine. If you're a student, if you're a young man. But if you're actually consuming hours of your life making stuff that people will take without any kind of co-investment, you're losing out. So part of the reason why I say give us money, give us a patch, is to force people to be involved. It's not just about being lazy, it's about forcing people to put a value on their need. And if they can't do that, then they're not useful, quite bluntly.
Okay, so I'm thinking of, say, something like the Ushahidi platform, which is used for disaster situations, I believe.
The Hexia, you mean?
No. Ushahidi?
Ushahidi, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And the people who use that are going to be people by definition in a disaster zone.
Right.
They don't have money. But they're the sort of people that you want feedback from to say, actually, we need a feature that does X.
I assume you're going to have, this is about disaster relief.
Yeah.
I assume you have NGOs who are specialized in talking to many people and filtering and getting back the real issues, removing duplicates and coming with their actual problem. And NGOs have an economic model based on helping people and getting grants to do that. So they're your real users, not your end users, but the ones you talk to. You can't afford to talk to a million people anyway. It'll overwhelm you.
Right, okay.
Oh, I wanted to add one more thing. So we actually, what license are you using for your software, Nick?
GPL.
GPL, okay, good. So we actually built eventually a protocol for building communities, software communities, based on GPL. It's called C4. And it's like a specification which says you shall, you may, you will. And it basically gives you a template for building communities. So you might look at that and see how that works for you. You can find it, C4. It's easy.
So the problem I've encountered so far with both sides is the small contributed problem. It's just like somebody, they don't really want to be part of the project, but they do have a patch.
Right.
Maybe the patch sucks.
Right.
But they are going forward with some code. The problem is, if you have enough of these small contributors and you're not enough core contributors, there aren't enough people to review the patches.
So we don't review patches anymore, at all. We do Wikipedia-style code editing. We say all patches are welcome. And if that patch gets unpatched again, it's very simple. We accept pull requests as long as you conform to, you know, it must be, we have a style guide. You must conform to style guide. If you have code that looks ugly, I'll say it's ugly. If you break the style guide, that's not going to happen. But if you conform to the rules, your patch will be accepted no matter what it does. So we get lots of little contributors. And the best thing is, if they're even semi-sane, we promote them to maintainer right away. We give them push and pull rights immediately. And so these little contributors become big contributors. Everyone starts timid and shy. Everyone. Actually, you don't want arrogant people coming in a project. You want the timid and shy guys coming in, because they're the ones that actually are careful. And so we accept every single pull request, almost without exception. The rules are very clear. The rules are very well documented. It's also very important. If your rules aren't clear, people will get things wrong. They'll make assumptions. So very, very clear rules. And we've made reusable rules just for this, specifically to answer all this kind of question. Does that help?
Yeah. I'm a bit concerned about malicious code getting into
it. Everybody is, but it doesn't actually happen. It's a classic discussion. And if you look at the commit history for ZeroMQ, for example, anyone can go and submit a patch, and this stuff is used by at least hundreds of thousands of people in production. You don't get malicious code. People do review code. People are obsessive about reviewing code. Doesn't mean you don't refuse pull requests.
Oh, yes, one question. So I'm taking some of your, more extreme comments a bit tongue-in-cheek, but you also mentioned that, say, people who've been with the project a long time, their opinions are a bit worthless. So if you extend that argument, basically the founders of the project are the most worthless people in the project.
I didn't say worthless, I said problematic.
Okay. Then that implies that founders are
drastic. Absolutely.
But how would you advocate, like, dealing with or switching founders?
So I think the sign of success in any open project is when the founders can step aside. Okay? And that especially, and I take this very sincerely about my own projects. If I can step aside and people can take over my code and make it do stuff that's good, then I'm happy and I can go away. And it's the worst thing. It's a sin to be needed in a project. It's a cardinal sin to be the founder and to be there, to be needed. It applies to all projects. I think. I don't think that's extreme. I think that's very modest. We go further. We try to say that you can't have a single founder. Projects must have at least two people to start with. So we never merge our own pull request, for example. So if I make a pull request, someone else has to merge it. So always at least two people.
I've also got another point for us. That's another one, which is, I guess, I sort of agree with your sentiments when you say that if you don't have someone to contribute, you can put but because you don't want leeches, obviously, and you don't want to get overwhelmed with people talking but not actually doing anything. But I think you do need to have a little bit of leeway, because if you're too extreme on one side, people will drive off, including the more timid people.
So, discussion is always good, yes. I mean, we have a very active user list, we have people talking, that's all fine. We do not have our feature requests. We do not have people just logging issues, it doesn't happen. If they do that, it gets ignored. It's very simple. Discussion is fine. Discussion about what we're going to do, that gets ignored as well. Because that's theoretical, that's philosophy. That's the Drupalist, whatever. I think we're out of time here. So after this talk, there's a bar. I'm happy to answer more questions, and I'm going to hand over to James now.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Right, hello everyone. I'm James Smith, and I'm here to talk about a thing called Clean Web, which is a word I have to explain a lot. Not something most people have come across yet. So, first of all, what the hell does that mean? I'll start with a bit of context. We've got some really big problems in the world, right? We hit 400 parts per million of CO2 last week, I believe. We have a low set of sea ice extent last year. We have really big global issues that we need to deal with. And we're growing out of control without cleaning up after ourselves. We're, you know, heading off and just leaving a trail of destruction behind us. And as developers, we know what happens when you do this. And everything's fine. Things sort of carry on as normal, but then suddenly everything goes a bit slow and then crash. We don't want to get to a point where we're blue screening our civilizations. On the other hand, we have the most amazing communication tool in history, It's an incredible behaviour change machine. You only have to look at the rise of things like Facebook, the change in attitudes to privacy over the last few years to understand that actually what we have here is something new, and mostly used for pictures of cats. So CleanWeb is this idea of getting innovators to use that web technology to fight things like climate change and build a more sustainable and resilient future. There's a lot hidden in here. Climate change is just one of the many problems that we have, but it's possibly the most immediate. So it's this thing in the middle of sort of traditional clean tech, renewable energy systems, things like that, sustainability ideas, and then combined with the latest web technologies, cloud computing and so on. And here in the UK, we've been doing pretty well. You can't read the thing at the bottom, but never mind. We've been doing this for a lot longer than anyone else. We've been building these kinds of things since before 2005, and there are projects going back a long time. The first carbon calculators were here. We have a more socially engaged developer community than anywhere else. And that's a great thing. A few years ago, in 2008, I stood up on stage in Conway Hall at a conference called Geek Kyoto and asked a very pretentious question. Can software save the planet? And it was intentionally pretentious because my slightly roundabout argument was, you know, don't be silly, do that. We can't create clean power, or we can't pull carbon out of the atmosphere or anything like that. It's software, you can't do real things with it. But we can help. You know, the point was we can do some stuff, but we're not going to really fix things. That's complete and utter rubbish. I disagree with myself completely. Every line of code that you write that helps somebody to save a bit of energy in their house turns off one of these and replaces it with the cleanest, greenest power source there is, which is no power source at all. Every time you get somebody off private and onto public transport instead, you take one of these off the road. It's a real effect. Every time you get somebody to buy something more local, you're emptying a container ship that's coming halfway across the world. So here's a few examples of people who are doing exactly that. We have Loco2, who are taking planes out of the air by helping people to book rail travel across Europe as easily as if they were booking on EasyJet. We have Sustaination, who are connecting local food producers and local buyers together in a LinkedIn style and emptying lorries. Amy are saving your pension fund by calculating the environmental risk of all these, of every single company in the UK. Carbon Culture are building communities and changing behaviours. And there's a lot more. So now my answer is hell yes, we can. We can really make a difference. And I would go further. I would say that the only thing that we can do fast enough, the only thing we can scale quickly enough to deal with the problem that we have, is software. We can't change anything else in the time that we have left, because there isn't much time. We have to turn things around very quickly. But we need a lot more of this. We have a few startups going, but we need a hell of a lot more projects. We need thousands of ideas to get to a few hundred things that make it to prototype, to get to 10 things that kind of work, to get to one that might just have a chance. We need a flowering of innovation in this area. And that's what we're for. This is CleanWeb UK. I'm the one of the organisers. We're a voluntary organisation, a developer community made of developers, trying to talk to developers, spreading this message, connecting that community that's been around for ages but didn't know each other, and building it up, spreading that message. To basically stop building pointless apps that help people click on adverts and go out and do something important. I think probably that's less relevant here. I think you guys probably all do much more important things anyway. But that's the message we're taking out in a slightly friendlier way. And it's not just us anymore now. So this is a global thing. There is an organisation that's just formed in the US called the Clean Web Initiative. It's a non-profit industry association type group who have a lot of friends in Silicon Valley and so on, and are organising hack days all over the US. They just announced, the mayor of Chicago just announced the Chicago Clean Web Challenge, which is a big push across the city to get lots and lots of this stuff going. There's lots and lots of things going on in Europe, and there's South America, and some stuff starting up in the Far East as well. So it's we're not alone anymore now. But we're still ahead, which is nice. This is Clean Web London, this is our meetup group. We have the most active community of this type in the world. We're almost, I was so hoping we were going to be at 350 by now, but as of this morning it was 346 members here in London interested in this stuff, meeting up on a regular basis to talk about it. We run events every month on various different topics. We have some talk tonight, so we've run events on cloud computing, open data, public policy, games. We actually got together last month and played games that had an environmental theme to try and inspire people to go and make better ones. And yeah, most of them are quite complicated. And finance. We're having a meetup on Monday on South Bank in Climate Change Capital's office, all about finance, how environmental issues will impact the finance and what you can do on the web to help with that. So we support people in the direction to start taking some action. What can you actually do? So the first thing we tend to point people at is, where does your code run? Where is it? It's just because we pushed it out into the cloud, there's a lot of talk about cloud computing being green. This is not necessarily true. Efficient is very much not the same as sustainable. And cloud computing is projected to be around 4% of global emissions by 2020. So this is not a small thing. It's the fastest growing area, except for aviation, or including aviation. I can never remember. Anyway, it's up there with aviation. And one, as an example, one Amazon extra large instance has the same carbon footprint in the default location, has the same carbon footprint as a human. So if you're using a few of those to power your data center, that's basically the allocation for a few people. The main thing is, where does the power come from? So one of our members, Mastodon C, who you may have seen talk downstairs earlier on about the analytics, prescribing analytics this morning, they made this thing, which is a carbon dashboard for all the data centres, well, not all the data centres, but a lot of the most popular data centres in the world, rating them on their, takes into account the power generation, the climate, how much air conditioning they have to use, things like that. So we can now see what's what, and the default AWS host on the East Coast in Virginia is not good, because it's all run on coal, it's all very dirty. But it's quite easy to change over. There are some much better solutions. For instance, we have here in London, we have London Rackspace, who buy all of their power from renewable sources. And if that's good enough for Greenpeace, which it appears to be, then okay. There's a data centre out of Muddlesham which runs on biogas generated from fields around the data centre. It's completely carbon neutral, run off the waste product from the local farms. Nobody uses it because they don't want to go outside London for their data centres, even though it's next to BT Martlesham, which has probably one of the biggest pipes in the country. But a really cool one that I like is GreenCloud. GreenCloud's in Iceland. And the nice thing about Iceland is the whole of Iceland is powered by volcanoes. So it's absolutely zero carbon. It's EC2 compatible, and you can just pick up your stuff from Amazon, point to GreenCloud instead. And, you know, your servers are powered by magma, which is cool. Or not. There are a lot of opportunities in this area. There was a quote I saw a while ago, which I ran out of time to look up, but a good way to come up with startup ideas is to look at big companies' annual reports and look at what the risks are that they think, and then start one doing that. It's a really nice idea. We have, we have some health and safety risks. We have some big risks in the current system. So this is a fantastic visualization from David McCandless, I think, and Dr. Clark at Guardian did some of the work behind it as well. This is the amount of carbon that we've released. 1,000 gigatons from 1850 to 2000, 380 since 2000, 500 left that we can safely release ever. We're going to blow through that at current rate by 2025, which is why we have to work quickly. The interesting thing is your pension fund, if you have one of those things, is invested over that side in the oil and gas that we cannot possibly burn. So it's definitely overvalued. So there are, how do we fix that? This is one of the things we're going to be talking about on Monday. But it's just one of the many opportunities of things that we could change. How can we rewire the systems to work for our to our advantage? We've written a manifesto, which is too long to read out, but short enough to read, that says, we know this is happening, we're going to do something about it. We're going to use the skills that we have, the tools we have at our disposal, which, as somebody else said earlier, it's easier now to make things than it's ever been. We're going to use those tools to build a better future rather than illusory short-term value. So we're looking for people to join us. These people already have. Aren't they lovely? You can go to our website, cleanweb.org.uk. You can sign the manifesto. You can follow us on Twitter. You can come and talk to us on IRC. We have mailing lists. Come to meetups. Come and join this community. Talk to others. We can all work together on this. That's the great thing about it. We're a whole bunch of startups who are all trying to solve the same problem together. Because if we don't, we're going to need some new error codes. A couple of minutes of questions, if there are any. You.
I'm not one for big technologies, but the problem, the obvious problem, is you are preaching to the convergence.
Sorry?
You are preaching to the convergence. There is a very large community of people who don't want to pair up.
Absolutely.
There's Americans who don't want to sacrifice their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. There are Chinese who want to have American lifestyle.
Yep.
So, what do you plan, what is your strategy for outreach? Expanding their messages.
So we are talking to developers who can, you know, who should have, who have an understanding of this and can apply their skills to do something about it. We're not trying to convince the general public. What we're trying to do is convince developers to build things that the general public would prefer to use without even thinking about it. If it's as easy for you to go and book a train to Amsterdam or something, rather than flying. If it's as easy, then everyone's on the same playing field, the prices will change, and somehow it's the same price and it's simpler to go on the train and it's just as easy to book it, maybe more people will go that way, but they won't do it because they want necessarily to be doing the thing we can do with the web is make the right choice easy. I think that's the power. You know, you're not going to convince everybody that they should change the way that they live because it's the right thing to do. People don't think like that, unfortunately. But we can make the right choices for the easiest one.